Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And those were the words of our famous founder, Brian Brown, of the Brown Briefly. We welcome you here on Tuesday, the 9th of June, and too many days into the current Trump administration than we even want to think about.
I believe it's around 11:50, as it were.
I am counting the days to the election, and we're down below 150, so that's encouraging news for us. We are just now being joined by our illustrious host, Mr. Michael Shook. And Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm here. Are you there?
We are here.
We are here.
I was looking for the link. Something. My apologies to our listener. So Brian's already made his introduction.
No, actually I haven't. We were waiting on you.
Brian has, but that's all.
Well, there you go. Yes. Well, it's Tuesday, the 9th of June, in the year of the twittering twit. And a June so far damp and cool and looking to stay that way for a while. And huzzah, I say, for that.
Because they have stolen everything but our summers, and now they're stealing our summers.
No, this is just typical January.
January. I call it January.
That's good.
January.
Right, July 5th. It'll be back July 5th.
Let's see. What else have I got here? At the controls of the wireless technology in the Gene Bosch studio is our pilot of planes and zoomologist.
Whoa.
In the studio.
Kerrigan House.
Yes, thank you. Boy, Lynn, you just about wiped us out here, girl.
Connection right now.
Sorry.
What did you do?
In the studio with Truman.
Sorry.
A safe ways away.
Sorry.
He's a many talented host of Real Talk, which follows us at noon. Surge activist, whole Vash on catalog co-instigator, Susan McCabe.
Hey, hello,
Susan.
Good morning.
Good morning, Susan. I'm going to go for my headphones here and look official. Let's see what else. Zooming in from home, our island historian, honorary Kiwi and or Aussie, and guardian of the universe, the man who soothes my frayed nerves, a bit anyway, by providing historical, not hysterical, context for current events, Bruce Hallman.
It's good to be here. I'm feeling more hysterical every day.
You can't say that, Bruce. I'm counting on you to keep me on an even keel. Oh, my goodness. From his bunker. Not really. I think it's from his office. We will hear the latest means and methods whereby citizens may engage in the political process, hopefully getting the nation back on track toward a better future for us all. And that highly relevant information will come to us from Indivisible Vachon's own Kevin Jones. Good morning, Kevin.
Ooh, hey. I have to comment on Bruce's comment that I'm feeling more historical every day as well. I just yesterday talked to a boyhood friend neighbor who I had basically lost contact with after we left high school and on our separate paths. But it is actually so sort of refreshing to be able to go back and connect with somebody who, you know, you spent 15 years of your life next door to, and then all of a sudden you reconnect after, well, more years than I care to mention. But yes, so
15 or 20.
Yeah.
about that, yeah. And I will say on Indivisible Vachon, we are now having our Sunday pep rallies every week at 4 o'clock where we gather, we talk about what's coming up for the next week, what's going on in the state of the election and how we are going to make a difference. So if our listeners are interested, they can email me at kevin@indivisiblevashon.org, and we will get you connected.
And that's, of course, via Zoom or something like that.
We are all becoming Zoomologists of the first order. So, yes, that's our standard go-to connection method now.
Boy, don't you
amazing.
Don't you wish you'd have invested in Zoom 2 years
really?
Ago?
Really? Yeah. If only we'd known.
There's a Georgia senator who did that right after the briefing on coronavirus, Kelly Loeffler, and she fortunately is probably not going to be well
received.
She's not going to get many votes today, I don't think, in the election in Georgia, but we'll find out.
Wow.
We can hope so. For those of our bent, I guess I should say, we should also welcome our Washington to Georgia to Washington, twice transplanted, retired semi-pro shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes, old-time music maker, retired social worker, and rabble-rousing poet Lynn Kerrigan. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning. And I have to tell you, I'm thinking a lot about Atlanta today because Atlanta, Georgia is in the midst of their primary. And today they are out in force trying to vote with multiple problems already happening in Atlanta between long, long lines to get to the polls and then difficulty with the new electronic touchscreen system of voting that they have there. And so I keep my fingers crossed that there's not further interference with the Atlanta residents' capacity to vote, as well as everybody in Georgia who is all using that same system. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about my friends and relatives there
today. Yeah. Well, certainly that the whole voter intimidation thing, and that can come in many forms. I think when people think of voter intimidation, they're like, oh, you know, bad guys with clubs and driving people away from the polls or threatening to beat them up if they leave their houses. But that can take many forms, and there's some subtle ways that can be done to, oh gosh, you couldn't get there. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, you know, I just want to follow up on that because we have been making a lot of phone calls into Georgia because not only did they delay their primary, they delayed their primary twice. And some people in Georgia, as I understand it, actually were able to cast a ballot in the presidential primary that was held back in March or something like that. But now they have to cast their vote again because of the delays, the twice delayed. And everybody got mailed a notice to sign up to get an absentee ballot. And the notice apparently looked like some kind of junk mail that would be something easily discarded. So it is amazingly hard to vote in Georgia, and particularly if you live in Washington, where it's like, fill it out, put it in an envelope, drop it in a mailbox, and you are done. So yeah, we've been making a lot of calls to let people know how to not only avoid those long lines, but get people onto some ballots and make sure they can vote safely.
Gosh, thank you, Kevin. I'm so glad to hear of the wide action that you are taking, not just within Washington, you know, which is kind of a bastion of the blue state, but to reach out into some of those red states or swing states to really try to support, you know, their rights to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, well done. Well, in this time, these troubled times, but there's great opportunity coming up here too. I'm heartened because, at least in part, overall, there seem to be signs that the rats may be abandoning ship as the corruption-encrusted garbage scow SS Trump looks to be taking on water and may well sink. The military brass have publicly chastised Trump for his abuse of power and are, to their great credit, saying a big no to Trump's efforts to misuse our armed forces, pulling troops from Washington, D.C. against the orange twit's wishes. A tiny group of Republicans seem to have actually found minuscule bits of spine. Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, and a handful of others are actually saying they're finding it difficult to to make the decision to support Trump in the 2020 election, which makes me wonder, what will it take for them to actually decide that? The NFL, Major League Soccer, the NBA, and even NASCAR have issued strong statements, not only condemning the recent horrific murder of George Floyd, but have called for deep conversations and action to root out systemic racism. The commissioner of NFL football, Roger Goodell, actually made a formal apology to Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback who took a knee four years ago in protest of yet another murder at the hands of the police of a black man. So there's hope there. Some police have marched with and or taken a knee with protesters, while Minneapolis' city council has voted to dissolve their police department and rebuild a force that would work with the community instead of abusing it. Statues across the South that commemorate heroes of slavery and the Confederacy are being torn down or otherwise removed. That floored me that that's finally happening. And the Episcopal bishop for the greater D.C. area issued a stinging rebuke of Trump for his photo op at St. John's Church, where he used a Bible as a prop. This after tear gas, rubber bullets, and flash grenades were used to remove a group of peaceful protesters from the area so that the cowardly piece of flabby orange garbage could make a show of how brave he is. And that after coming out of the White House bunker, where he was no doubt wetting his pants with fear.
No, no, no. He was only inspecting it.
Ah, he was inspecting it.
You folks at home can't see me smiling, so but these guys can't.
Inspecting it while he wet his pants.
Exactly.
Finally, looking for a corner to hide in. Finally, worldwide, people of all colors, creeds, ages are marching, protesting, and demanding their fundamental rights as human beings. What are we witnessing? What are we taking part in? And can all this anger, frustration, and momentum be translated into lasting change? Those are some thoughts on the day.
Boy, and those are the big thoughts of the day.
Let me just jump in here. I mean, we're at a historic moment. And, you know, and historic moments come very infrequently, you know, and we're lucky enough to be alive through one and see it happening before our eyes. What's interesting about this historic moment is it's been created by a pandemic. And so we're going to see the kinds of sweeping changes that you saw after the Black Death, after you saw after, you know, a smallpox epidemic swept through Europe and through the Americas. You know, it's a fundamental changing of the social sort of contract that's going on. You know, how it'll work out, you know, where it'll go is a little difficult to know at this point. But no doubt in my mind that we're in the midst of a major sort of social sort of shift in Western culture, at least. So
it reminds me a lot of 1968, which was the culmination of the deaths of Martin Luther King, as well as the Kennedys, as well as Vietnam, as well as the militarization of the police following the Kent State murders of protesters there. It was a sea change that eventually brought about the fall of our military operations in Vietnam and brought down the Nixon administration for being so bitterly partisan that they would stoop to robbing, you know, a Democratic office to try to get dirt on their opponents. And I think we're seeing another major refusal by the Black community to stand still for their population continuing to get murdered and treated inappropriately by the police. The profiling that has gone on here, frankly, since the Reconstruction era of Andrew Jackson. And, you know, I lived through the Jim Crow South. And so I see it as a giant refusal for one more difficulty with the inequality of our system that's been developed pretty much to keep whites in power. And I'm very humbled and honored to kind of be a part of this opportunity for us to rethink what should change, what could change, what will change. And I think those are going to march forward slowly and not necessarily in concert.
Susan, yeah.
Agreed. It's another time that Black people have stood up and said no more, and not a lot has happened after they've done that, because it is about white supremacy and it is about white people taking action. It's about, I'm not even going to call it the white majority anymore, because I don't think we are, from a technical perspective, the majority in terms of numbers of bodies, but we are the majority in terms of power and domination and supremacy of systems. So nothing is going to change until white people recognize their privilege and the fact that it is our white supremacy that is oppressing Black and brown people.
Kevin, yeah.
And I agree, Susan. And the notion that, you know, it's really intriguing to me now that we are so working so closely in this election space, right, with primary elections happening, the presidential election now less than 5 months away. And we have had this awareness of racism in this country. The 60s clearly shone a spotlight, a very bright spotlight on it. And now we have another really bright spotlight. And I think I mentioned last week that Bakari Sellers said his 75-year-old father faced the same problems and challenges that he faces today as a 35-year-old Black man in America. So what causes change, right? What will ultimately make things change? And I keep coming back to the notion that we might, lawmakers who are not people of color, may find that lip service is going to get them through this tough patch, if you will, if you want to characterize it that way. But only people, lawmakers and decision makers of color, will probably persist and really stand by their values and move us in a direction that will finally put some of this behind us by changing some of the regulatory framework that allows this systemic racism to continue at all levels, right? When it comes to redlining of real estate transactions, when it comes to access to money for loans for small businesses, whatever the issue is, we know that it's there. And we know also that it's easy just to hide it and brush it aside because we don't have these events that capture the national or global imagination like this one has. So now I think is the time that we need to not only look at what those changes need to be, but we need to support people who will live with their culture and vote in a way that will make a difference. And there are several women of color running for office in Washington State. There's opportunities to make phone bank and phone calls for two of them. Kevin at indivisiblevashon.org.
Well said, Kevin, and Susan and Lynn. It's interesting to me that what you brought up, Susan, people of African American heritage are not a large part of in sheer number terms, as you say, of the overall population of the country. And without, I guess I'm just reiterating what you said, without the majority white population really examining its behavior and then acting on what is found out from that to support real fundamental change. And I hope that that's what we're going to see come out of that. Part of it, I think, may be that I'm old, you know, my kids have kids now. And my daughter's generation, the 30 somethings, have a whole different take. Many of them, of course, not all, but many of them see things very differently and are actively supporting emancipation, full participation in the commonweal. Susan.
Michael, I think that is what will actually make a difference. I agree we have to pass laws that fly in the face of systemic racism, but we can't legislate morality. And I don't know how those laws will actually be enforced or how vigorously they would be enforced unless the attitudes and the mores of the nation change along with them. Laws are always a good start, but it requires attitudinal and societal change in order for something to really happen.
What I want to say is that I think so much of our moral compass is top down in some ways. Really, it works bottom up, but what we see and have been seeing recently are leaders who are now standing up against the code of silence that has been blocking the Republican Party from anything other than Trumpism. I was really heartened when General Mattis, followed by General Milley, stood up and said that the Constitution is what they have an oath to, the existing laws. They refuse to see the military be drawn into matters of general, I don't want to call it policing, let me call it response to the protests, because there's a number of responses that have come out to all these mass protests. But for me, I was interested in watching the courage of these generals finally saying, no, we will not lend military force to this kind of continuation of a response that is heavy on the use of force against blacks. Mm-hmm. And that they decried the shift away from protecting the Constitution. We need to recognize that what's been happening is a protection of Trump, allowing him to get away with so many things, and that people are now standing up against that. Lisa Murkowski said that she was grateful to have heard one of the generals articulate that again, which kind of tells me nobody in the Republican Party has really talked much about we have a constitution already that guides us. And many of us have not been paying attention to that. I was thrilled to see the revolt of the generals and ashamed to see Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense, stand by Trump in front of that church holding up a Bible as a prop. Mm-hmm. But at least he had the guts to walk back what he did. And I think that we need to see some whites show some humility and some guts in lawmaking that show some leadership that we can make a lot of adaptations, certainly in our policing, but also structurally.
There's a kind of a, of course, all this is about power, and political power translates into economic power. And one thing I'd like to get some views on is how embedded in our way of thinking it is now. It's become embedded in our way of thinking that in order for some people to have a decent standard of living, other people have got to be kept down. And so it becomes this sort of zero-sum game of winners and losers. And it's based, I think, on this whole consumer capitalist idea that there's only so much to go around. It's scarcity. And so if in order for us to be able to go to the store and Walmart or something and buy a shirt for $10, we don't think about that. Well, where did that shirt come from? It came from someone in Pakistan or India who's making 10 cents a day sewing that shirt or something. And so it's our computers that we're using, our phones, all of these things are made in countries where the people making them have no rights. China, we all know, has a horrible, horrible human rights record. And yet we do billions of dollars of trade with them every year because they've got a poverty-stricken populace that we can take advantage of. So it's really interesting how money flows around the world, and wherever it's easiest to for a nation to collectively put its knee on that other nation's neck, that's what we wind up doing. So it's going to take a sea change of people recognizing that we're all in this together. And there is plenty for all of us. We just need to change how we're thinking about that. Any thoughts on that?
We are a consumer society, and we, United States, is the most responsible country in the world for consuming the planet and for exploiting other humans on the planet. We think of a good standard of living as what would be considered incredibly wealthy in the past. How we are going to change America's view of what middle class is, what an acceptable standard of living is a big question mark for me. How are we going to make that happen? Maybe the fact that we have been cocooning all this time has given us time to recognize what we really do need and how much we don't need. At the same time, if we actually, as a collective, decide that we don't need all that stuff, there's a whole lot of folks who are going to be out of work. So it's a bit of a conundrum, and it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out.
Another aspect of that, Michael, that comes to mind for me is that, you know, now, well, we've, you know, I grew up in, first of all, it was the Made in Taiwan, right, label that was on a lot of things. And then it was the Made in China label that was on a lot of things. You mentioned Pakistan and India. So we also now see Made in Vietnam. So it's intriguing to me that that trade has lifted China to a whole different level of economic prosperity that they did not have before. And in seeking the lowest cost producers, American companies who do produce overseas are now moving to other countries. Mm-hmm. And China views that as a threat, in which their economic prosperity is now jeopardized by their economic progress. So it's quite intriguing. It is driven certainly by capitalism. And we've seen unconstrained capitalism has a number of problems that we find troubling. But on the other hand, capitalism has merits that other economic systems don't. So it's an interesting trade-off of where, you know, how we want to use these economic rules, if you will, right, to guide our practices.
Well, sure. As you mentioned, the standard of living in Vietnam right now is completely different than it was 50 years ago. I mean, completely different. It was a rural agricultural community with very little industry, very little modern, whatever, conveniences. I mean, even roads and power and, you know, communications, those things just did not exist 50 years ago. And now it's amazing. I've talked to friends who've gone over and they just said, you just would not believe it. Completely changed.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the other end of that spectrum, though, I think that our form of capitalism, we've talked about this a lot, has kind of become a winner-take-all kind of capitalism with less look at the middle class, which has always provided, you know, the bulk of the purchasing power within America. And we have lost much of the middle class. If you read into not just political inequities, but economic inequities, we are at a point in history where it's like the 1890s, in which, you know, a very small percentage of people owns a lot of this wealth that we're talking about. It's why you can read that there's both a great recession and the stock markets are booming, because people with amassed wealth can benefit from a stock market resurging, whereas people who are wage earners in low-paying service jobs do not benefit from that at all. And I think we have to look at whether we want our system of capitalism to be so brutal and lopsided. And I think, as in addition to the emotional turmoil, Bruce, of the pandemic that you mentioned, you know, as part of the root of all of this upheaval that is happening socially now, I think another thing is that we were due for an economic pushback, just given only the economic disparity in our country. And so now we kind of have three things: a pushback against the racism that we've built our country on, a kind of horror of what's going to happen in the pandemic and how society will fall apart and need to be restructured, as well as sort of looking at the general sense of economy in the U.S. I just think, you know, we don't have much of a middle class that's being protected anymore, and it gives us an opportunity to really rethink how our laws have benefited mostly the wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, what do you?
No, I came across just this week a website which I thought was fascinating, and I recommend our viewer take a look at it. It's intentionalist.com. So it would be like intentionalist.com. And when you go to that website, you can enter a product that you're looking for, and you can enter like the type of business owner that you would want to purchase that product from. So you can select businesses of color, you can select small businesses, etc. And it is local. It will show you in various communities where you can find those products and the kinds of businesses that you might prefer to use your purchasing power to lift up. Because we as individuals also have a lot of power in this system. But it's the fact that it's distributed, and only a little bit of individual power, but collective power, can be pretty substantial. So websites like that, I think, can help us, help to maybe to shape the system that we're in.
Using that technology, that's great, instead of the technology using us. There are some really wonderful things about all this stuff, even for a Luddite like myself. Yeah. Bruce,
you've got
some thoughts on these things?
To me, the most encouraging thing going on right now is that even though these protests and this sort of a movement that we're seeing right now in the country is motivated by a Black Lives Matter sort of ideology or approach, it's broader than that. It's much, much broader. And the participation is much broader. And the issues that are being raised are much broader than just racism in terms of police actions. It's looking at the systematic nature of racism. It's looking at the way that we structure our police forces. And it's the way we look at what the role of the military is. And so what you're seeing is almost like, I like the analogy of the perfect storm, where you've got multiple things coming together and focusing on a moment in time that just is forcing us as Americans to step back and look at all these preconceptions that we've made. And people are reassessing. Broad ranges of Americans are reassessing who they are, what they are, what their attitudes are. And that's the most helpful thing. That's revolutionary. And what we're going to see is a cultural and political and potentially economic revolution spin out of this, which is the result of pandemics that happens after every major pandemic in one way or another. And so I'm very, very hopeful. It's not going to be an easy road.
No.
But it's a very hopeful road.
Kevin, what's your...
And you know, I'm really, that perspective, I think, is so helpful. And the thing that we have today that's happening, this is the day of George Floyd's funeral in Houston. If you've seen the coverage of people paying their last respects to this person that was well-known and well-loved in the sports and the local communities in which he lived, is just one piece of information that tells on what Bruce just said. The other piece of information, if you look at Trump's approval rating on 538 over history, his lowest low was 36%. His highest high was 46%. He is currently at 41% and a steep downward trend in approval. We, of course, will see what transpires over time because he's had a very durable base. But the notion that his approval rating is now declining quite precipitously in response to all of this. And then just yesterday, introduced in both the House and the Senate, the Justice in Policing Act, which is a possible step towards making changes, these durable systemic changes to combat the durable systemic racism that we have in the country. That bill faces little chance in the Senate, but if our listener and us all call our senators and let them know, those calls matter because they can then talk about the outcry and the outrage that they're hearing from representatives and from us. And that's important to tally up those voices.
Lynn.
I wanted to add to that, Kevin. I was so grateful that you brought that up because I think there's both happening. There's foreground and there's background, you know, history and the present. There's the abstract systemic things that we have to get to, and we get to them from concrete action in the present. And I've been reading a lot about what is being called for in this Black Lives Matter movement about policing specifically, and I've been really heartened at the number of very concrete steps that people are now asking for. So what I'm saying is beyond the outrage, beyond the concern of individual actions, it's now being looked at things like, you know, improving police ability to de-escalate, decreasing mm-hmm. their use of force, really looking at the questions of qualified immunity, the assumption that they're there to do good and that accidents will happen, to look at reasonable force and malice aforethought versus other ways of judging when force is used. I think the question about how much the police has been militarized, getting weapons from the military and using weapons of crowd control that are harmful, can be looked at, should be looked at. And I think that the whole idea of investment in the community has got to be relooked at so that Blacks aren't seen as pockets of trouble by anyone in our country, but they're looked at as a community just as deserving of protection and safety as any of us. So I'd like to see policing shifting its values from control to protection and safety.
Yeah, that's a...
I would like it to as well. And the one thing I'll just quickly add is that, as George Floyd's funeral takes place today, you know, that's just one less reminder of what's transpired. But I hope to see things like the Black Lives Matter painted on Pennsylvania Avenue spread to cities across the country. Every statue that comes down, every Black Lives Matter road painted is just one more statement about how we need to stay on to make sure to get people aware and talking. So those fundamental changes legislatively that you just mentioned have a chance to continue to move forward.
That's great. I loved seeing that in those huge letters.
It was wonderful.
Street. It was marvelous.
I'm really curious about what Trump's response to that has been. Would you love to be a little bird in the corner to hear that?
Furious. Holy cow. I think we have queued up. I thought we usually end the show, as our listener knows, with that wonderful song, The Harbor Lights by the Platters. But today I thought it would be great if we could end it with a lovely version of Lift Every Voice and Sing, written by James Weldon Johnson, a poem, and then his brother put it to music in 1900. So if we've got that queued up, and the lyrics especially are wonderful.
Thanks, Michael.
Adios for now.
See y'all next
Thanks,
week.
Thanks, everybody. See you next week. Harmony.
All right. Thank you very much, folks. And we'll see all of you guys next week. Huh? You're still on just for a minute longer. So, all right, folks.
Bye-bye, everybody.
End of the Brown Briefly.
Joe Biden, it's time to choose Stacey Abrams or Kamala Harris right now.
There it goes. All right. Bye-bye.